And I give you Mary Pearl. Mary, you have the floor.
Okie dokie. You didn't tell me we were going to do this to midnight. Okie dokie. I enjoy it. I love sharing the coins and everybody who have the recovery. Before the record books, my name is Mary Pearl. I'm a grateful Al-Anon. I came into the program January the 15th of 1977. And so I'm considered a bleeding deacon, I believe now, at this point in my life. Anyway, I am grateful to be here. Thank you so much, Owen, for asking me to come and share tonight. Like I said, I was thinking 7 o'clock, man, that's good. And then I thought 9 o'clock. Okay. So now I've got my second win and we'll see how this goes. I am the youngest of four children and I am the change of life baby. I was the surprise. There is 16 years between me and my closest sibling. And my mother said that she didn't even know she was pregnant until she felt life. And she said, "What is that?" And went to the doctor and he said, "Guess what? You're pregnant." And she said, "I can't be." And that's what my daddy, who who was 54, said too. He said, "You can't be." So I was raised by old people. And that's what I used to call them. Well, now I'm past them. So now I can't say that. But anyway, I will be 80 before very long. So when I was a little kid, I learned right off that daddy was a fun person and mother was not. My mother would have qualified for Al-Anon her whole life, but never found it necessary to come. I found it necessary for her to come a long time before, but you know how that goes. It's for people who want it, not for people who need it. And so my daddy and I would go hunting and fishing. He was retired by the time I was born from 38 years in the military. And he said he was going to fish and hunt and raise bird dogs. And that's what we did. And I loved it. I was a tomboy. I loved being with daddy. Mother, on the other hand, she felt like if she wasn't working, if she wasn't doing something that was bringing financial income into the home, that she wasn't worth anything. And she was a dressmaker and designer and a very good one, I found out as time went on. But to her, when she made something, it was homemade. And it was real funny when I realized people from all over the country got her to make things for them, but I didn't want anything homemade. I just didn't want anything from her. Every time I'd go to mama to talk to her, she would say, "Shut up, leave me alone. Can't you see I'm busy?" And so I did. I shut up. I left her alone and I stayed with my daddy and the dogs. It was wonderful. Daddy and I love to go hunting and fishing, and I get tickled, especially when they talk about all the gun stuff that's going on today. I was taught to use a gun at a very young age because that was for bird hunting, for God's sakes. It wasn't for people hunting. And anyway, I wanted to tell you a little bit about my personality. By the time I was 5, I think all my character defects were in place. They were all in place by that time. Daddy and I were going fishing one day and she decided to ruin the trip and she came with us because mama can't have fun. She can't enjoy herself. Everything has to be a job and she has rules and she has to catch the first fish, the biggest fish and the most fish. Other than that, you can fish. Wasn't that nice of her? And so I made a mistake right off and I caught the first fish. Well, it was just a little old fish. It wasn't but 4 or 5 inches long. And my mother took one look at it, ripped it off my hook and screamed, "It's not a keeper," and threw my fish back in. Well, now I don't know about you, but I have a thing about fishing. If it has eyes and a tail, string it. For God's sake, you know, she threw my fish back in. Well, I went to this screaming coma right there in the boat. And daddy said to me, "Honey, come here in the back end of the boat with me." And as I got close to him, he said, "And we'll get her." I didn't know what it meant, but intuitively, I knew I was going to like it. And what it meant was every time she'd catch a fish, she'd swing around. He'd take it off, rebait her hook. She would swing back around and start fishing. He'd give me the fish, and I would put it over the side. Every fish the old heifer caught that day, I threw back. It was wonderful. I had this when I was doing an inventory. I wrote this down as one of my most pleasant childhood memories. Shows you what kind of kid I was. Well, like I say, Daddy and I, we loved dogs. We loved animals. We loved all that kind of stuff. Mother had no time for any. And every once in a while, we'd sneak one in the house just to irritate her. I've realized now that Daddy and I played a lot of games against Mama at the time, but I just thought it was fun. I didn't realize how hurtful it was being to her. Anyway, on November the 30th of 1954, my world ended as I knew it. I watched my daddy die of a heart attack, and I was left with her. Well, now, I had gone with Daddy to church every Sunday and on Wednesdays and stuff, but all of a sudden now I know that everything I've heard was a lie, because I had heard that God loved me, and I knew that God didn't love me, because if he had, he would have taken her and left me my daddy. And so I turned my back on anything spiritual or having to do with God at that moment in time. And I also did something very early. I went into denial. I went into denial. My daddy has gone to the Dakotas. He's gone pheasant hunting, and he'll be back. And I kept telling myself that. And then later on that summer, my mother heard me telling a friend that, and that Daddy would be coming back, but he was up in South Dakota. He was pheasant hunting. And she came in and she slapped me across the face and she screamed, "He's dead and he's never coming back. Get it." And I hated her that much more. You know, you hate the person that brings you the bad news. You know, it doesn't make any difference. And I hated her anyway to start with, so it didn't make it any better. So we had declared war in our house, and it was whoever dies first, the other one wins. And it was just me and her. That's all that was left at the house, because my siblings were either dead, married, or gone by the time I was any age at all. And I had this sister that was 16 years older than me, and she got married when I was 8 years old. And I didn't realize it at the time, but she was going to be super important in my life. Well, as time went on, whenever I would want her to go against Mama for me, in other words, to plead my case with Mama, Dorothy was there. She was always there, and she made me feel special from the far back as I can remember. My sister made me feel special, and I took it for granted. And I looked to my mama to do the things that Dorothy was doing for me. And I didn't give Mama, put little X's against Mama, but I didn't put any check marks against Dorothy, because I didn't know that all sisters didn't do that. And so that's one of those things, when you're looking for one direction to get something, you might be getting it from another direction. Don't discount where you're getting it from. And you see, that's what I did. Well, in the late 50s, they decided they'd put an Air Force base in Little Rock. And they there was an ad in the paper, there was an article in the paper about the fact that there was 10 men for every woman in the Little Rock area. And I thought, hot damn, I want my 10, and I want your 10, and I want anybody else's 10. There's never too much of a good thing. If it feels good, do it till you die on the spot. I mean, I am an adventure junkie. My drug of choice is adrenaline. If I don't have some, I create some. That's just the way I am. Now, you get adrenaline with good behavior, but you get adrenaline with bad behavior too. And I didn't really care which way it come from. I just had it. My first time going to jail, I was 16 years old. And it could have been something simple like speeding. But by the time I got through with it, the charges were speeding, refusing to stop for the cop, resisting arrest, kicking the cop, you know, things like that. And guess what? They take you to jail for that. And so there I went. But I had to keep that a secret from her, because I never wanted her to be on my case, because her was abusive. Now, you know, my mother's modus operandi was, I brought you in this world, I can take you out. And so my mother, who had no way of dealing with her anger, she used to take it out. And when she would take it out, she wouldn't be happy unless she had brought bruises or blood or something. You know, she has to leave a mark so that you will remember. And I was so sick, I refused to cry, because then she would have won. And you see, it was a war. And so I'm not going to let her win, so I don't cry. Now, I could have got a lot less abuse if I had cried, but I refused to cry. So that made that's smart on my part, you know, let her kill you. Okay, but at least I won. Whoopee-doo. Well, when this base went out there, like I say, I went with some girlfriends. We went out to the bowling alley trolling one night, and there was all these guys from out of the base, and we were all bowling and what have you. And I met this one, and I really didn't care for him, because if you realize on the bowling, the table, score tables were slanted, and he set a cold drink on that, and it went right all over me. And I wasn't real thrilled with him, but he got my name and address because he wanted to get my slacks cleaned for me. And so that's how it all started. But you know, the thing that he said that made me love him was, "I'll take you away from home." My God, I would have gone with Godzilla if he had told me he'd take me away from home, you know. I wanted to get away from home and her so badly. And I said, absolutely, absolutely. I was in love with the idea of being in love, and I fell in heat about the same time. So we got married. And so now he was in the Air Force, and they had signs everywhere that said, "Join the Air Force, see the world." And I can't wait to see the world. Now I'm just thinking, you know, let's go to Germany or France or Spain or someplace really exotic. And we did. We went to Newfoundland. I had no idea where it was. I looked in the atlas, and it said it's a little teeny island off the east coast of Canada. Even Canada doesn't claim it, you know. I mean, it's way out there. And it was like going back in time 100 years, like we were in the States, you know. Newfoundland was a very, very small. It was called semi-remote. God forbid you should ever go remote. So we ended up there. Now, when I got off the plane, I'm from Arkansas, and we have maybe 1 or 2 inches of snow on a good year. And I got off the plane, and I went into snow up to my butt. And I can't believe it. I have never seen snow like that. And that was just the beginning. You see, the average snowfall in Newfoundland was 290 inches a year. And so we had 9 months of snow. It was exciting, you know. Not really. There's not much you can do in that kind of snow. And like I say, semi-remote. The town had like 5 or 6 stores. That was it. And then you had the base. And so it just wasn't much. And see, the main thing, it wasn't exciting. Now, there was a couple of strange happenings along the way. I looked out my kitchen window, and my kitchen was about the size of my bathroom here. And I looked out and I said, "What are those strings stretched across the top of the snow?" And my husband said, "I don't have an idea." Well, we found out when the thaw came in July, that were clotheslines. I mean, that's how high the snow was in the backyard. And then, you know, one day I'm standing in my kitchen, and all of a sudden a coat rack goes past, and there's a moose standing in the yard. You know, those things weigh a ton, and they're gigantic, and they've got horns that go out the rack, goes way out, sometimes 6 foot or more. It's really something to see. And then, I mean, there was that kind of stuff, but the main excitement for me was on the bass. And my husband played lead guitar in the band. And so he was playing all the different clubs on the bass. And so I'd go out there, and while he was playing the guitar, I'd sit at a table with a bunch of the others, and I'd troll. And the first time I ever saw slot machines, they were nickel and dime machines. I don't even know if they have those anymore, but they had handles. And I mean, I was so excited. I had gone to the real world. And no, it was not exciting enough. I had to have more excitement than that in my life. And my need for excitement cost me my marriage while I was there. I did go to work for the American Red Cross. And I enjoyed that because it was just a 2-person office, and our territory was Newfoundland and Labrador, and we worked 24 on, 48 off, and it was a good job. When it came time to transfer, and we stayed until the base closed because of the fact that they didn't need our help anymore. They needed planes that could go further than ours could go to refuel. It was a refueling base. And I called down to the SAC assignment section, Strategic Air Command. And I said, where are we supposed to go? And the sergeant down there told me, he said, y'all are supposed to go to Minot, North Dakota. Minot? I'm not going to Minot. My God, that's more snow. I'm sick and tired of snow. He said, where do you want to go? I said, I want to go back to Little Rock Air Force Base. Now, I couldn't wait to get away from home in Little Rock Air Force Base, but now I've got to go back to Little Rock Air Force Base because don't you know it's going to be different now? Don't you know? Well, it may be, but I wasn't. You know, it's wherever I go, there I am. And I didn't know that. I just thought things would be different when I got back home. Well, whatever. Anyway, did I bother to ask my husband if he wanted to go to Little Rock Air Force Base? No, I did not. Did I care? No, I did not. It was all about me. And so when I asked the guy down there, I said, well, he said, there's not an opening in your husband's career field. I said, well, can't you create one? I mean, my God, what's the matter? Got a pencil? And he said, no, I can't create one. And I said, well, then change his career field. He said, I can do that. And so with a stroke of a pen, my husband, who was an aircraft mechanic, overnight became the head of a missile inspection team. He had never seen a missile. But that's the military. Anyway, we got back home again. And by the time they got all that straightened out, I had made up my mind. I'm home. I got back where I wanted to be. He can go on. I don't need him. And so that's what we did. He went on to his next assignment, and I stayed there. Now I'm free to do whatever I want to, whenever I want to. I don't know what to do. You see, I'm a reactor. If you're not doing something for me to react over, I really don't know what to do. But I did notice there was a neighborhood softball team. And so I went out and got me some stretch boots and some hot pants, and I joined the team. And it was fun. It was really fun. After the games, we'd go back over to somebody's house and we'd discuss what our strategy was for our next game and what have you. And some of them would pop a few tops and some of them were smoking funny cigarettes. Then there were those that had those sugar cubes. They were the weird ones. And then there was that little white powder they were chopping up and down. Never could understand the people that chopped that stuff up and down. Because you see, alcohol did it for me. I didn't have to bother with drugs, and I am so grateful today, so grateful. And I am so grateful, too, that a couple of drinks of alcohol did it for me. Because, you see, my mother's father, mother, two brothers, and two sisters were all alcoholic. They all died of the disease of alcoholism. And my mother had told me, don't drink because we carry the bad seed. Well, when she told me not to drink, I had to drink. You understand that, don't you? When you're rebelling, you just have to do. And so it was one night, and we were over at my house after the game, and there was this kid that got drunk at my house. And I'm thinking, this is not good. The sheriff will be here to see me. And he had already been to see me a couple of times about my parties. And so I said, I will drive him home, and y'all can follow me and bring me back. And so they said, all right. So he had a pickup out in the front and got him in it, and he could barely walk. And there was this box on the front seat, and it had a China tea set in the middle of it. And I said, what is that? And he said, I got that for my mother for Mother's Day. And I thought, good Lord, he will break that for sure. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to save him from breaking that, and I'm going to carry it in his house. Nothing he's asked me to do, by the way. But you know how helpful we are. And so here it is. It's wee hours of the morning. I'm going into a strange house with a drunken 18-year-old kid. Never seen these people or this house before in my life. And he flips the light on in his bedroom, and there's a man laying on the bed in nothing but his jockey shorts. And he looks up and he says, well, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. And I said, not tonight, fella. But that's who I'm married to, sitting right over here in a chair, you know. And people say, how did you meet? Well, now in AA and Al-Anon, you can tell them the truth, but it just doesn't work real good out in the other part of the world. You know, they don't understand stuff like that. But, you know, we're very accepting, and we know that bizarre things happen with the disease of alcoholism, you know. And now, Alcoholism. We date for 4 years. His drinking didn't bother me that much. He only got drunk 2 or 3 times. It wasn't a big deal. And then he ruined everything when he asked me to marry him. Because there's a time to tell things, and there's a time if you go past that, that it doesn't appear to be a good time. And what I had forgot to mention was, I was still married. Well, he said, married? You sure didn't act married. I said, I forgot. I was having such a good time, I forgot. You see, he wondered how I managed to live alone, have a new car and everything. That was that allotment check I was getting every month. I wasn't about to get rid of my income if I didn't have to. You know, I was very tacky. We'll just say that. We'll just let it go with that. Anyway, so I filed for divorce, and guess what? Alcoholism moved into my home. I didn't realize I had had it all my life. I had had the family disease of alcoholism all my life. I had inherited it from my mother, and her relationship with her family. You see, alcoholism is a family disease as well. There's those that drink it, and then those that have to be around the ones that drink it. You know, that we have to be the ones to stop it. And so anyway, I had all of my defects in place by now, as you can tell very well. I'm super self-centered. I don't care how things affect other people. I don't care anything about anybody but Mary Pearl. Well, we got married on the 7th of November of 1969. And come Thanksgiving, I had a fully stocked bar when we got married. Now, we didn't live together before we got married. Anyway, when people came in, you said, what would you like to drink? And I didn't have any alcohol left in the bar. And I'm going, where the hell did it go? I mean, I have a German Shepherd and a poodle. You know, we weren't drinking that much. Where did it go? Now, see, denial is already in place. Because denial says, I'm not going there. Because what else? Who else could have drank it? It had to have been him. But when you don't want to see what you don't want to see, and you don't want to hear what you don't want to hear, you don't. It's a wonderful thing. Denial is an absolutely wonderful tool. You do that to keep from losing your mind totally for a period in time, Well, needless to say, the drinking is progressive, and they say it's an allergy, and I believe it, because he broke out in spots. New Orleans, St. Louis, Memphis, you know, he would just go and be gone for days. And then he'd come back and act like he'd been gone 15 minutes. And in another 30, I had been convinced he hadn't been gone that long, and it wasn't that big a deal, because I didn't want to end the relationship over it. And so when you don't want to look at things, you don't look at things, because you don't want to have to take the action you know you're going to have to take if you admit this is really happening. And so I became a part of the, you know, it's hell, it's hot, but I'm not here. You know, that's the way I was. And then finally, I got to the point where I couldn't stand it any longer. As time goes on, as we all do, we get to that point. And so I took him to the family doctor. Now, the doctor now knows what's wrong with me. He'd been treating me for nerves, high blood pressure, first one thing and then another, but I never told him I was living in alcoholism. But now JD tells him he has a slight drinking problem. Slight! And so the doctor told him, he said, Alcoholics Anonymous seems to have the best key to that, not the medical profession. And he gave JD a number that he could call. And JD says, I'm not an alcoholic. I said, that's right. He's not. He's just a drunk. He's not an alcoholic. Now, Grandpa was an alcoholic. He died of wet brain from alcoholism. Grandma was an alcoholic. She died of cirrhosis of the liver. Uncle AB was an alcoholic. He was shot while he was drunk in bed with another man's wife. These were alcoholics. JD was not going to be that way. I was not going to let that happen. That was not going to happen at our house. And so I left there with this prescription that he said he wanted for some antabuse, because he had several friends that were taking antabuse. And so I left, and I went and got it filled, and I became keeper of the pills. So now I've got high blood pressure, JD. I've got an epileptic dog, and JD's on the pill. Every morning in a hurry, I can't guarantee who got what, but everybody got a pill in this household. And so here we are. Well, I've said, if he'll quit drinking, I'll be okay. Guess what? He quit drinking. I am not okay. And I begin to analyze the situation. You know how we do. We have to think about it. And when I hear people I sponsor say, I've been thinking, I get cold chills, you know, because that's where our problem is. It's right up here, you know. It's our thinking that is so bad. And if you're reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and you take the word drinking and put thinking, you have got Al-Anon right there. That's where we are. We are the thinkers. They can be the drinkers, but we're the thinkers, but we all go to hell together. And that's the thing. Well, anyway, he's not drinking. I hate him more now than I did when he was drinking. And I can't understand why. Because you see, if he'll quit drinking, I'll be okay. That's like I have a headache. If you take my aspirin, I'm feeling better. But it doesn't work that way. You have to take your own medicine. And so I had none. He had no treatment for his alcoholism, and I had none for my family disease of alcoholism. And so that's the summer that I went completely over the edge, because I began to realize it wasn't the drinking, it's him. I just hate him. Well, then why don't we get a divorce? Well, this is when the committee moved in that summer. And the committee, it was like this. I'm miserable. I am too. Well, what do you want to do? I want to get a divorce. Well, you can't get a divorce. Well, why can't you get a divorce? Because if you do, what's the common denominator here? I'm not going there. Okay, then, well, what do you want to do? Well, you know, if you could be a widow, what? If you could be a widow, that would be acceptable. Oh, I like that, but he's not dying. We can take care of that. Oh, good. What do you want to do? Well, let's see. I want to stab him in the neck with an ice pick and watch him drip. That was one of my favorites. And so, again, I began to feel better, because there was light at the end of the tunnel. He was going to die and I was going to be okay. One more time, somebody else has to do something for me to be okay. And so I kept waiting and waiting, because I knew sooner or later he drinks again. In the meantime, I read an article. A woman's husband had gotten drunk and she killed him, and they put her in prison. That wouldn't have happened if I'd have been on that jury. But anyway, so here it was. We had to have another meeting of the committee. And so we decided that if an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? Who would know? We all liked it. It was a group conscience. So I just wait, because sooner or later, he always drinks. And guess what? Sooner or later, he did. And when he did, he came and he had missed. We had a little bit of ice and snow here in Lura. And he came across the driveway, across the yard, hit a tree, didn't even bother to come down the driveway. And he poured out of the truck. And I had seen that too many times. When I looked out my front window, I said, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. So when he came through the door, violence had been in our home a long time, because see, I'm like my mother. I don't know how to deal with my anger either. And so I just hit him as hard as I could, and he fell and he hit the coffee table. And I drug him down the, and it knocked him out. And I drug him across the living room floor, down the hall, into the bathroom, took his clothes off of him, put the bathtub full of warm water, put him in and held him under. I wanted him dead. And the voice inside of me says, look what you're doing. You can't do this. I picked him up by the hair of the head and I said, the hell I can't. And I pushed him back down. And then the voice came back and it says, do you not realize you're taking the life of someone you once loved? No. They said, this is murder. No, it's justifiable homicide. No, this is premeditated murder. Scared me to death. I jerked him out of that bathtub. Thank God I had worked for the Red Cross. I'm a senior lifesaver. And so I was able to resuscitate him and drag him into the bedroom, dried him off, got him in the bed. He's still out. And I got the hair dryer down and dried his hair, because I didn't want him to catch cold. You talk about crazy. And then I go sit in my living room for the next 8 or so hours, and I'm rocking. And I'm trying to, I can't live like this. I just can't live like this. But I don't know how not to live like this. So I just get up the next morning and do what I've always done, which is go right back into denial. And I went off to work as if nothing had happened. A couple of days later, when I come in, he has made it out of the bedroom. He is sitting at our bar and he's not drinking, but he is shaking. Oh my God, he is shaking. And he said, would you call this number? And it was the number the doctor had given him for AA. He said, I have tried all day long and I keep getting the wrong number because we had push button phones and he's shaking. He was getting the wrong numbers. And I called and they told me there was a meeting in 1 hour's time, 6 blocks away from our house. It was in a building that was built by my grandfather who died of alcoholism. And it was a community building. And that's where AA met. So I took him to his first AA meeting. And there was two ladies, they came over to me and they said, we have Al-Anon, it's for you. And I looked at them and I said, there's nothing wrong with me. How quickly we forget, And so that was that. Well, he was so blessed. God was really there on the job that night because this old man came over to him and he said, boy, I'm going to be your sponsor. And I looked at him and I thought, I am not impressed. Grandpa looked worse or better than you do when he dead, when we buried him. Anyway, I was not impressed. And so, but that old man saved JD's life. He took him around and introduced him to all the AA community in the county where all the meetings were, everything. And JD is a master welder and he could work and drink on the job. And when he got sober, he couldn't. He was shaking so hard, he could not weld. And so he lost his job. And that's what made me go to Al-Anon, because I had just two things to ask. How do you keep an alcoholic sober? And how do you manage when there's nothing left to manage? And they said, we don't know. And there was two ladies that had come to visit the new Al-Anon group. They had only been there 4 months. They just had some pamphlets. No books, just some pamphlets. And they came over and they told me there was meetings where all they were in town and what have you. And I began to go with him and his sponsor to the open AA meetings, which I loved because they were laughing and having fun. And then we went to the Al-Anon meetings. Oh, now there was the sad group, you know. They're over there talking about resentments. And by the time the meeting's over, you have one. You know, there wasn't a lot of how to get out of a resentment. There wasn't a lot of recovery going on, but hey, it was a meeting. And then I wanted to be part of AA because they were having fun over there. They were exciting, but my drinking just didn't qualify me because it doesn't do for me what it did for them. But I love to go to their meetings. And so it just so happened that I got a sponsor whose husband and another gentleman were working on a big book study they were going to take around the world. And I got to sit in the floor and listen. And I was raised on that same big book. Now, the first time I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I read it of what he ought to do. And then the next time I read it, I began to identify because I knew what my problem was. I knew now that I had a problem. And my sponsor, who was the most wonderful woman, I had her for 45 years. She passed away this past January. She was 97 with 54 years in Al-Anon. And I was so blessed to come into what I call the golden years of program, because I got to meet all of those heroes of AA and Al-Anon from way back then. And they were all so kind and loving and helpful. And there wasn't any yin-yang between the fellowships. You know, I was treated just as well and nice by all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was never referred to in any of these tacky comments that you hear sometimes today, you know. There wasn't any of that because when I came in, everybody in Al-Anon had someone in AA. You had a loved one in AA, and there wasn't any yang-yang. We got sick together. We got well together. That was how it was. We met in homes and stuff. So, I mean, that's just how it was. Well, anyway, time goes on, and JD and I, we had to quit focusing on our relationship. We did not have a relationship by the time we got here. It was a delicious hatred both ways, you know. And so our sponsor suggested, instead of us trying to work on the relationship, that we work on ourselves, because you can't bring to a relationship what you don't have. And so we began to work on ourselves. And so people say, well, how was that living together? I said, well, it was better than it was when we first started, because we'd go to the meeting together in the same car and we'd cuss each other out all the way to the meeting. And then we'd get there and go, isn't the program wonderful? And then we'd cuss each other out all the way home. It was so phony. And then my sponsor said, take two cars. I said, good thought. Now we're 7 blocks away. We could have walked, but we couldn't have been together on the road even walking. And so we took separate cars. And if he wanted to go and talk with people after, if I wanted to, we had the freedom to do that. And people say, well, what did y'all do in the way of a relationship in the home? What about sex? I said, sex. Every time we pass in the hall, we'd yell, screw you, at one another. I said, that was the sex. I said, y'all just don't understand. We weren't talking to one another here, because there was so much resentment and hatred. He hated me from all the physical abuse. I mean, I broke his bones. I knocked out his teeth. I did those things to him. He had these other women. One night he brought one home and he said, she didn't have a place to go tonight. I said, guess what? You don't either. You know, this was the kind of way we were living during the active alcoholism. You know, you just don't overcome that overnight. And then after a couple of years, one night I was at a meeting and we were talking about changes during the past year or so. And I thought, you know, I had begun to get a little respect for him and stuff. And I thought, you know, I might even like him if I got to know him. And so that's when we begin to use traditions to try to work on our relationship, but not until you got the steps behind you, because the steps are going to give you the tools you have in order to do that. You know, the steps are the recovery. You are guaranteed one thing in those 12 steps, a spiritual awakening. And that spiritual awakening will help you solve every problem you have that's going to come down the pike. And we have had a bunch of problems. But we have overcome them because we both had a higher power and we both had a program and we worked it. That's the difference, you know. That's the reason we'll be celebrating 53 continuous years of sobriety. Second marriage for two ain't too bad here, you know. And I remember I'm married. And he remembers he's married. Isn't that amazing, you know? We have found all those things here. And we have found such a deep and abiding love for one another. You know, when people were talking about the pandemic, and yeah, we've been locked up for over 2.5 years. In 2020, I used 2 tanks of gas, and that was to go to the pharmacy and to doctor's appointments. And last year, we used 3. You know, we've already bought 2 this year. It's scary in me. But anyway, we'd done what the doctor said, and JD's got high blood pressure, her heart condition. Let me think, what else? Oh, sleep apnea, and he's diabetic. We can't afford to bring anything in this house of pre-existing conditions. That's all we are, is pre-existing conditions, you know? And then JD's also now having some memory issues, and that's a whole new ball game. But the same higher power that brought us this far is helping us. Now, in 2012, I retired from speaking because I couldn't walk anymore. I couldn't stand anymore. I have extreme arthritis in both knees and hips, and I did not want to go out of this world a mechanical person. And so I can't walk. I can just barely get around on a cane here in the house, but outside I have an electric wheelchair. First time I got in that, I went to the grocery store, wiped out the end cap. That was fun. I can't help but laugh about that. Anyway, moving right along, I had to develop that relationship, but the most relationship was not with him. It was with her, my mother. And all of these years, you know, we have had this war thing going on. And my sponsor would give me directions to take that I didn't want to take. And one of those was to send my mother a proper Mother's Day card. Now, I said the last one I sent her that was like I wanted was a Maxine Shoebox card that said, the longer you bitch, the longer God lets you live. And she was in her 80s. She was not appreciative of the card. And I thought it was perfect, though, because that's what she did all the time. And guess what? One day I look in the mirror and I become my mother, because all I'm doing is bitching. You know, it's one of those things that comes upon you. Whatever you look at like that, it will come back upon you. And so I started sending her one of those syrupy cards I didn't want to send. And time went on, and my sponsor said, I want you to practice and ask God to let you see your mother like he sees her. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, well, when God looks at us, he looks at us through eyes of love, because God is love. And if it's not good, it's not God. So when God looks at her, he sees her as his child. We're all God's kids. We're all equals here. That's what I learned in Al-Anon. It's a fellowship of equals. No one is any bigger or better than anyone else. It's an equal playing ground. We've all been affected by the same disease. So I started praying that. I didn't want to, but you know, I've learned over the years to do what my sponsor said, because it always worked out better, because she had a straight line to God. And whereas I would have to wiggle around and do my thing for a while and then give up and then ask God for help. And so anyway, I began to pray the prayer. And after a year or so, I came to her and I said, how long do I have to pray this damn prayer? She said, just till it works. I said, oh, okay. So I keep praying the prayer. And so one fall, I go over. I'm driving in my mama's driveway. It's a long driveway. And I look and she's out in the back. We had 10 acres, but she was about midway and she was raking leaves. She loved a pretty yard. And I realized my mother's short. Now, is that an awareness to come to sitting in your car in a driveway? After all these years, mama is short. And I said, God, why wouldn't I have known mama was short? Because she was always such a big thing to me, because she was the authority thing. And she was the one that punished me and tortured me and wouldn't love me. And he said, because every time you go as a little child, you never go as an adult taking anything to your mother. You come wanting, a little child wanting something from your mother. Oh, dear God. And as I walked back toward her, it was like I could see in her heart. And I always felt like she had love, but she just wouldn't give it to me. She'd give it to my sisters. She gave all she had to my brother, who was killed when I was like 9 years old. And why didn't I see it? Because I felt like she withheld it to punish me. And I didn't know for why, because what could I have done as a little child that made her hate me from the beginning? And so as I come up to her, I realized if anybody's going to have to bring love to our relationship, it's going to have to be me. Because see, in the program, you learn anything you want, you got to be willing to put out. You got to be willing to do it if you want it back, because what goes around comes around. So if you want something, put it out and then it'll come back. I said, oh, no. But see, I'd learned how to love in rooms like this with people like you. Excuse me, JD. Anyway, so I thought, what am I going to do? So I walked over to her and I gave her a hug. And she was stiff as a poker, because we don't hug, we don't talk, we don't touch, we don't anything like that. And I thought, oh, my God. And so every time I went to my mama's, which was two or three times a week, because it's just me and Dorothy to take care of her, I'd give her a hug before I left. And you know, she got to where she'd stand up for those hugs. She'd walk into those hugs. She wouldn't hug you back, but she would do those. And then after a year or two of that, I'm thinking, this is pretty good. We can talk. We can do a few things. I went by my mother's one day and she was in her sewing room and she said, I want to ask you something. She said, how come when your daddy died, you became such a rotten, ornery kid? I said, I was getting even with you for not loving me. And she said, really? And I said, yeah. She said, what made you think I didn't love you? I said, mama, You never told me you loved me. I never did anything to suit you. I could clean my room to where I thought was perfect, and you'd find that one thing I hadn't done, and you'd pounce all over it. I said, it didn't make you. I never got a you did good. I got a you screwed up. I said, why would I think you loved me? And she said, well, I gave you a roof over your head. I gave you clothes to wear and food to eat. It was more than I ever had. You see, my mother had been raised in that home with those alcoholic parents, and her daddy kept exposing himself. And then he tried to rape her when she was 13 years old, and she ran away from home. And she lived in culverts and stole food out of people's gardens, and she walked all the way across Tennessee till she got to Memphis, and she was in an alley. And there was a boarding house on that alley, and this lady owned the boarding house told her if she would come in and work there for her, she would give her room and board. My daddy, who was much older than my mother, was the head of the recruiting office for the Army in Memphis. He took his meals at that boarding house. And that's where they met. And when she turned 16, they got married in the parlor of that boarding house. Now, if you had lived like she lived, what would be the greatest gifts you could ever have? A roof over your head, clothes to wear, food to eat, something she had not had, but what had wanted to give to her children. And I just looked at her when she was sharing that with me, and I said, Mama, what can I do today to make it up to you for all the things I have done over the years, many on purpose to hurt you? What can I do today? What can I do today to change that? What can I do for you today? And my mother looked at me and she said, forgive me for not being the kind of mother you needed. And I looked at my mama and I said, Mama, I forgive you. And my mama got up and she walked across the room and she put her arms around me and she gave me the hug and she kissed me on the cheek and she said, baby, I love you. I've always loved you. And I knew to the best of her ability she had. I knew it within me, just like I know it today. And she's been gone since 1991. And I also realized that God had given me a mother to take care of me and do all these wonderful things for me. I kept looking to her for. He gave me Dorothy. Dorothy had been doing those things for me all those years. I didn't give her credit for doing it, but then I took it away from Mama because she didn't. So crazy. The family illness is a crazy thing. But you know, my sister, who was always there for me, God gave me the opportunity on November the 30th of the year 1999, 45 years to the day I watched my daddy die. My sister died in the front seat of the car with me. And I took her to a hospital that's 7 blocks away that had just opened a couple of weeks before. And they told me there was very little hope. She was already turning blue. Took about 12 minutes, they figured, to get her there. And because it was bumper, bumper traffic. And then they came in and told me that she had had her kidneys had shut down and they had done emergency dialysis and they had jump started her and she was in a coma. They didn't know if and when she would wake up. And after 30 days, she woke up. But her memory did not. And my sister had no short-term memory for the rest of her life. And it was my privilege to get to care for my sister the next 12 years, 1 year for each minute that she was down. Now, she knew who I was. She had lost 20 years off of the top. But I could be with her all day long, walk out of the room, come back. Oh, you're here, you know, because she couldn't save anything. Her save button was gone. And I told God the other day, I said, I haven't done that for 12 years. I said, were you just preparing me for this walk that I'm beginning now? I don't know. I just know that God is here with me, and I will get through whatever I have to get through and go through. I don't ever have to do it alone. And it has felt lonely this year without my sponsor. And I've been praying about that for the last year and a half because I've had some training there because she had dementia before she passed away. But I am so fortunate in that I have a sponsorship family, just the ones I sponsor. And we meet through Zoom. Thank you, God, for the pandemic that gave us Zoom or whatever. And we meet every other Thursday at 11 o'clock. And I have 25 people there. And I got one of the fellows was saying the other day, he said, I've got 36 years and I'm in the middle. And we were adding up just at that one meeting. And we had over 700 and some odd years of recovery in that meeting alone. And I said, I don't have to do this alone. You know, I don't have to do anything alone. I have y'all. Because you see, I have no biological family. Neither does JD. It's just us. But we have our extended family. And they're worldwide. That's what is so neat. You know, I have sponsored a girl in Africa for years. And then she moved to Portugal. And then we just talked on the phone. And now we can see each other. And she even came to see me, you know. But I have one in Australia, actually, Tasmania. She's here. And I have the one in Portugal. I have one in Scotland. And then I have them all over Canada and in the U.S. And I am so blessed, so very, very blessed to have these people that they're my kids. You know, I had no children. Thank you, God. I would have been a child abuser, no question about it. And I said, this way, I have kids that I can love and that can love me back because they don't have to be with the sick Mary Pearl. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but he worketh steadily. Oftentimes in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget he sees the top while I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly, will God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you.
Please, everybody, unmute yourself. Let's give Mary Pearl a wonderful thank you.
Yay. Thank you.